books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we hear about the new thriller from Mari Hanna, Her Sister's Killer, the latest in the Stone and Oliver series. We'll pay tribute to narrator Steve Hodson, and we'll hear from Morris and Marlin, an extraordinary tale of shipwreck, survival, and love by Sophie Elmhurst, winner of the Nido Gold Prize. All that on today's Read On. If you're listening to this broadcast/podcast on the day it came out, released yesterday, was Her Sister's Killer by Mari Hanna. Another outing for Frankie Oliver and David Stone. Although at the start of this book, they are no longer working together. As with most of Mari Hanna's audiobooks, it's read by Colleen Pendergrast.
You can always tell a cop who's new to death. You get the bare facts. They don't look you in the eye. They can't see past the image in their heads. They can't get away quick enough. Desperate to process what no training course has prepared them for. The grim reality of policing. When it finally lands, some don't stick around. Who can blame them?
Her Sister's Killer, as you probably tell from the title, is about Frankie Oliver's sister's murder, which I started right at the very, very beginning of the series, giving Frankie a backstory that involved the death of her sister when she was 11. And I wasn't quite sure all that time ago when I would introduce that story, but I obviously wanted to resolve it at some point. Like all my books, it can be, you know, read or listened to as a standalone. This was obviously an incident that blew apart her family, and the case has remained open and unsolved since that time. So I knew, really from the outset, I knew that Frankie would not be allowed, even though she is a murder detective, to be involved in the investigation into that dreadful crime. So it's kind of why I left the previous book, Blackfell, on a cliffhanger. I promoted her out of this murder investigation team into uniform, which is what happens when police officers are promoted. They can't just stay within their department. They have to go back into uniform and then go back as a detective elsewhere. So in order to allow that to happen, I had to separate them. In the previous book, Blackfell, which was book 4 in the Stone and Oliver series, I took them off to Iceland, the two of them, David Stone and Frankie, and then he was called back to the UK. And then the next time we see them and everything's tied up, they're at a leaving do, and they get quite close, and then David overhears something moments, you know, after the party started. And it's the question this book asks is, what was it that he heard? And why does it disturb him so much? And why does it trouble him enough to review Joanna's case? And in order to do that, he needs to keep it off Frankie's radar because he doesn't wish, you know, nobody wishes to upset her. So he actually embarks on that investigation alone. And it causes all sorts of problems. They get into an awful mess, you know, because, as I say, at the end of Blackfell, they were very close. And there was a hint that there might be a romance in the air. But then when this book starts, he has to really give her a wide berth. So she's wondering why. She's wondering what has she done. And Frankie being Frankie doesn't just get on with the new job that she's got, which is in Berwick. But she asks around and she wants to know, why is it that he's just not being honest? She can tell that he's not being honest. So she has a major investigation to unfold in the Berwick-Edinburgh area, which crosses the border, obviously, with Northumberland. And then he is dealing with this. But both those stories will come together as we progress through.
The first domino had fallen. Others followed, knocking down the next and the next until the last one fell, a solid wall collapsing inside Detective Chief Inspector David Stone's head, a metaphor of what was to come. If his suspicions were correct, the murder investigation team and those working within it would crash and burn, Frankie Oliver along with them. David had been about to slip out of the police club when he overheard a comment that blew him away. Adam Hall had come to the party with another man he didn't recognise. He guessed they had gate-crashed, taking advantage of a free bar. As he continued to observe them, harsh words spilled from Hall's mouth, words designed to injure.
Now, as with all of your books, they can be read as standalones, but let's zoom out a wee bit. Tell us about who are Frankie Oliver and David Stone.
When I started at Orion Publishing, I changed publisher. They wanted me to write a new series, and this is it. And it was their choice. They wanted to have a duo because obviously I had the Kate Daniels series was well underway. They wanted me to write something specially for them. And I came up with these two characters. David has worked in the Metropolitan Police for 15 years. When he returns home to Northumberland, raising another question as well, because he takes a demotion to come home. And Frankie, obviously, when she meets him and finds out about this, wants to know what on earth has gone on. Something's happened in his life and we don't know what that is. And kind of as the series goes on, we develop an understanding of what has happened to him and why he's come back. And Frankie I made into a third generation cop. So there has been a Frank Oliver in Northumbria Police since 1966. And so she's from a long line of police officers. And I think, as probably people will have worked out, that she's kind of joined the club, the police, not only because her father and grandfather were in it, but also to eventually solve Joanna's murder. So she's a little bit younger than David. She's very committed. She's very feisty. She says what she wants to say. They're a good partnership. They get on really well. There's a lot of humour between them. And yeah, they're a great couple to work with. So it was a bit different, this book, because I had to sort of deal with one investigation with Frankie and then this other one with him really keeping his cards very close to his chest, even from the MIT, because as soon as he talked to the MIT, then Frankie would find out about it. So he takes one officer and they work together. But yes, they're a good couple and they get on really well.
Anna Jónsdóttir, an Icelandic DCI who'd flown in as Frankie's special guest, was standing nearby in a figure-hugging cocktail dress, in stark contrast to those who'd got the memo that the party theme was glam rock. Uncomfortable with the exchange going on next to her, she moved away. Egged on by his pal, Hall persisted, ignored by those around him, except one. If David had to describe the expression on the face of their target, he'd have said it was a mixture of fear and rage. So strong was the reaction, it triggered one in him too. The hair on his head stood on end, as if a blast of cold air had swept in from the Arctic, bringing with it a ghost he knew by name only. Even if he'd been able to dismiss what had been said, he'd never forget that look. He was never meant to see it.
And Frankie's dad still looms large in the background.
He does, because that case was never solved when he was serving. He's now retired. And he has his own kind of little murder wall at home where he looks at it and he tries to solve this case. And he feels that he's missed something along the way, but it evades him and has evaded him all these years. And I think at the one point in one of the books, Frankie had said to David, you know, what makes you think that we could solve this case or you could solve this case when my dad hasn't been able to all these years? So there's a lot of backstory in there. There's a lot of, he's got his own little den at home where only Frankie really goes. Everybody else leaves him to his own, but she's been in there and she's seen his murder wall that is hidden behind a background. And her mum doesn't know anything about it. So there's a bit of a secret going on between the two. But they get on so well. They are, like, really, really close.
Now, you've said before you never a fart ago for your research. You yourself were a probation officer, but your career was cut short.
Well, my probation career was cut short, so I have a lot of experience in working with police and courts and social services. I worked in a prison for a while. I've worked with offenders and victims as well. And of course, my partner is an ex-murder detective, so I do not have to go very far. I mean, literally, I have to go downstairs into my kitchen and ask a question if I'm a bit stuck, or she will read my manuscript. If there's a point where I say, "Have I got this right?" She's my first reader, so that's, where that comes in.
Am I correct in saying she was the first ever female detective in Northumbria?
Yes, she was. She had a fantastic career, 30 years. And I think from a police point of view and from my own point of view, working within the criminal justice system, I kind of wanted to explore the ripple effect of a sudden death, which is magnified if it's deliberate and not accidental. And some victims' families just never ever get over it, and they're the ones we see on TV all the time. So I thought it would be, I mean, the Oliver family have done their very best to get on with their lives, and they have. And I think Frankie's parents were very keen to make sure that their other two girls had a good life. But this has always kind of loomed in the background.
Now, this might have a personal answer as well, but you've said you're living your cop life through Kate Daniels. And one question I never followed up on the last time we spoke is, what were the reasons she hid her sexuality during her career?
Well, I mean, it's still sometimes a bit difficult to come out in the police. I think it's more okay now, but it used to be very frowned upon. And kind of the first book that I ever wrote, which was a Kate Daniels book, was very much based on Mo's experience of being in the police and not being able to be who she was. That was drawn into that Kate Daniels series. But in this series, Frankie's sister is gay. She's not a cop, but she is married to a cop. So there is a like an element of that in there as well. But in this case, this is a much more up-to-date, out and proud, absolutely no problem with being who she is and being who they are, which is quite refreshing.
This is more of a book industry question, but did her sexuality affect the publication of your first book?
Absolutely, it did. I remember being rejected over and over again for the Murder Wall, which was my debut, and wondering why, because all the comments that came with it were, "We love this writer, we're just not sure, but really sorry, but we're going to pass on this." And I did obviously had lots of conversations with my agent about this, and whether it was just because they perceived a risk that having a main character who was gay wouldn't sell well or what have you, because they're very risk averse business, there's no doubt about that. But again, we're talking about sort of 2009-ish when I was on submission, and things have changed since then for the better. Hopefully they will continue to go that way, but at the moment, the current way things the world is at the moment, it doesn't look like that. But yeah, so eventually what happened was I won the Polari First Book Prize with that book, and straight away the Guardian wanted to talk to me, and they wanted to talk about being published and the fact that she was gay and Kate was gay and all of that. And I found that I said I had absolutely no problem writing the book. Why would I? Because I was writing about somebody who's like me. But it was getting it through that door, pushing that door open a little in order to get published was much, much harder. But we got there in the end, and Kate has gone on and won so many awards, it's unbelievable. A Dagger, a Crime Book of the Year for Capital Crime, Diva Wordsmith of the Year, or I could go on, but it's been fantastic. And is obviously now in development for television. So, and we're very close to having a broadcast answer. So, but that's all I could tell you at the moment.
So you're
There's no.
glad you stuck to your guns.
I did, and I did actually did say, I bet, we had this conversation, and I said, if Hank was the boss and she was the, She was the sergeant. Would that have made any difference? He said, I'm sure it would, but let's just stick with it. This is the book you wanted to write. This is the book that means so much to you. And eventually, strangely enough, I was published in Germany before I was published in the UK. And once, I was published over there, things started to move for me.
Now, the voice of the Oliver and Stone series and indeed Kate Daniels is Colleen Pendergrast. Why do you keep going back to Colleen?
Well, I think she's fantastic. I actually only met her, I think it was last year. I went down to London and we'd corresponded, obviously, because sometimes she needs to check things or she'll come across a spelling mistake or something that's got lost in the edit or has gone through in the edit that shouldn't have. Or she wants to know how you pronounce a particular word. So we have texted and emailed, but I'd never met her, and she is just so good. I just think, she's obviously an actress, so she can do the accents, the various accents, but she's very, very good and very careful. I like her, and I'm sure that your listeners do too. When we met, it was just like we'd known each other for years. I mean, I haven't always had her, but I've had her for very, very many books. I think probably at least 10 out of the 16 that will be out there, she has been my narrator, and I like her. I rate her. She's good.
Now, talking of the listeners, let's briefly touch on a book that isn't narrated by Colleen, The Silent Room, one of the first Matthew Ryan, actually. Let's talk about the blind character in that book.
I have not seen very many blind characters in books, and I know, I live in a small village. There was a lady who used to go to the railway station, and I saw her on the platform so many times, and she was so good. She had a dog. She had a helping dog, and she's so confident, and I just thought how wonderful it would be to have someone who was that confident that people, didn't she didn't act in any way that she was disadvantaged. She was absolutely on it, never needed any help other than from her lovely animal companion, and she was so lovely to talk to as well. And I just, I've not seen her actually since that. I don't think I've seen her because I don't go to that station very often. I would love to tell her that I kind of based my character on her. And my character is a very able person. She works for the Crown Prosecution Service, and I remember having a chat with an agent once who said, "Well, how can this person be blind?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And how can they work in the Crown Prosecution Service and be blind? Or how can they do this and be blind? And I went, well, of course they can. Of course they can be blind. They can be anything they want. And I found that very bizarre, actually, a question. But I have had lovely notes from people to say that they're very, very pleased to have seen that I've used a character who was blind in a book, because it does not happen very often. I'm really keen that all people are represented in fiction. So on that occasion, I chose, to kind of base my character, who is Matthew Ryan's sister, twin sister, on a blind person. I hope I got it right, because if you go into that kind of area that can be very sensitive to people, you must get it right, because otherwise you're upsetting people, I think. And we don't want to do that, do we?
Now, you mentioned it right at the start, the book before this one was Black Veil. Now, I was very recently at the setting for this book. Tell us about Kielder Water and the legends that surround it.
Oh, do you know? I love Kielder Water. One of my happy places. I don't live that far away, and you go up there, and it's just so quiet and so peaceful. It's a huge reservoir, man-made reservoir that was made in the 70s, I think I remember, that opened in the 70s. And it is the legend that comes from it was all encompassed in that book in Black Veil in great detail. And there is the legend that the village of Plochettes that was drowned when they allowed the water in, that people can be heard floating up to the surface. And I do have someone who actually floats up to the surface when an Icelandic group of young people are camping on the shores. And it's kind of that's part of my mem you know my imagination. And I went back and researched a little bit of that, and then found out all sorts of things about other areas that were utilized in the Second World War and so on. And I brought all of that in. But it's the people say that at low tide you can see the steeple of the church. I'm not sure whether that's the case, because Kielder is actually very, very deep.
Research for your books, most of the locations you could get by walking from your house, basically. But as I say, Blackfell was partly set in Iceland. Did you travel out to Iceland for research?
I've been to Iceland several times because there is a crime festival called Iceland Noir. So I've been there very, very often. Well, I think four times I've been, and I really love it. And actually, when I was thinking about Kielderwater as a location, what I needed a place that was equally beautiful and isolated in plain parts, not, nobody living there. And Iceland fit the bill perfectly, because obviously the interior of Iceland is very, very lonely and very, very beautiful. And so it really matched with the book, which is why I chose it, which is why I made the students Icelandic, so that I would take people there. In the same way that I did in another book, I took people to Norway, which is where my brother lives, and I was able to actually draw it really well, which was lovely. And actually, Norwegian newspaper wanted to talk to me about, why did you put this in the book? Nobody ever talks about this. So that was lovely, because it is nice if you're introducing people to a new and different area.
Now you're travelling out to Iceland for a crime festival. You've got three crime series. You're involved in the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival. What is it about crime writing that keeps drawing you back?
Well, I think I'm a reader first, and crime was what I used to read. I think the other thing is that it's where a lot of my life experience is. I mean, for example, when you're married to a police officer, and a lot of police officers are your friends, you hear their voices, you know how they sound and how they talk. When you're a probation officer, you hear the voices of offenders. So kind of I'm not lazy by any means, but why not use the experience that I have, because it's so authentic. And that's what I'm aiming for, really.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the Arnaby Library or from anywhere else is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Our Sister's Killer?
The cover is basically, it's Frankie, and she's looking out to sea, and it is a beautiful landscape. But there's kind of like a loneliness about her. She's just standing with her back to us, looking. Searching for answers, and it comes from kind of one of the scenes in the book. It's St. Edward's Bay in Tynemouth, the image. But it's a very evocative cover, I think.
Now, Frankie's standing on the cover alone. You've hinted at it before, Jink. Frankie and David are ever going to get together?
Oh, well, you'll have to listen to the book to find out whether that happens or not. I couldn't possibly give that away at this stage.
Surrounded by family and friends, newly promoted inspector Frankie Oliver was feeling ambivalent. She wanted and deserved the next rank. She'd earned it. That said, her departure from the MIT was tinged with sadness. Temporarily, she was destined for a new post in Berwick, regulations dictating that she must return for a stint in uniform before rejoining the murder squad. David had reassured her that it wouldn't be for long. In theory, that sounded great, but in police work, there were no guarantees. That gut-wrenching thought worried her. All around, beneath congratulatory balloons and streamers, detectives were having the time of their lives. After a complex, often divisive investigation, where opinions had been split both in the UK and abroad, the infighting was over.
Our Sister's Killer by Mari Hanna, as read by Colleen Pendergrast, is out now as an e-book in print and in audio, wherever you get your audiobooks. And Mari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Marihanna will be back at the end of today's show with the books of her life. Still to come, we'll pay tribute to narrator Steve Hodson, and we'll hear clips from the Nero Gold Prize winner, Sophie Elmhurst's Morris and Merlin, after this.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
The winner of the Nero Book of the Year Award is Morris and Marilyn by Sophie Elmhurst. It was previously the winner of the Non-Fiction Award earlier in the year. Bill Bryson, the chair of judges, said Morris and Marilyn is an enthralling, engrossing story of survival and the resilience of the human spirit. Sophie Elmhurst's writing is understated but powerful, immersing the reader intimately in the unfolding drama and the horror of struggling to survive against the odds.
4th of March, 1973. Marilyn looked out at emptiness. There was little to see except the water shifting from black to blue as the sun rose, a clear sky, the ocean, and themselves, a small boat, sailing west. At 7 o'clock, Marilyn left her watch on deck and went down to the cabin. Morris was still asleep in his bunk, stirring a little. The morning would follow the certain rhythms of every other morning, coffee and breakfast, then all the checks and jobs a boat requires. A formula so practiced after months at sea that it had become as automatic as time. Except this morning, in the precise moment that Marilyn put her hand on Morris to wake him, they felt a crack, a jolt, the sound of a gun going off, as if the violence had come from her touch. The noise split the air, books leapt off the shelves, cutlery flew.
What begins as an eccentric English love story turns into one of the most dramatic adventures ever recorded. Morris and Marilyn couldn't be more different. He is as cautious and awkward as she is charismatic and forceful. It seems an unlikely romance, but it works. The audio version of Morris and Marilyn is read by Florence Howard.
They thought of their boat as their child. To hear her wood tear and splinter was like hearing the pained scream of an infant. Up on deck, they discovered the cause. A whale was next to them in the ocean, massive and alive. Water was streaming down the dark cliffs of its body as it twisted and writhed. It looked like it was trying to climb out of the waves, hauling its dark bulk up, then smashing back down, a meteor landing in the ocean, showering spray. Its tail, 10 feet across the flukes, was beating at the surface in a kind of fury. Blood poured from its body into the water.
Bored of 1970s suburban life, Marilyn has an idea. Sell the house, build a boat, leave England and its oil crisis, industrial strikes and inflation forever. It's hard work, turning dreams into reality, but finally they set sail for New Zealand. Then, halfway there, their beloved boat is struck by a whale. It sinks within the hour, and the pair are cast adrift in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Marilyn couldn't understand where it had come from. She'd just been up here, waiting for the dawn, and seen nothing but a fishing boat when she'd taken over from Morris at 3. You don't miss a whale. But perhaps you do. It must have risen from the depths just after she'd gone down the ladder and broken the surface right where they were. She couldn't bear the thought that they'd somehow hurt the creature. It seemed uncanny that in the entirety of the Pacific, this would be the spot it chose. What did it matter? There it was. A sperm whale, Morris could tell, from the blunt, square block of its head. He knew his whales. It was 40 feet long, he guessed, a good 10 feet longer than their boat. This close, it was difficult to take in. Whales were best admired from a distance, like certain kinds of paintings. He could identify its parts, the blowhole, the lower jaw, the pectoral fin, but they didn't seem to add up to a coherent whole. The creature was out of proportion, unnatural in its size. One rogue swipe of its tail and they would be cleaved in two. It was monstrous, he thought, only compared to them.
On their tiny raft, over the course of days, then months, their love is put to the test. When Morris begins to withdraw into himself, it falls upon Marilyn to keep them both alive. Their pet turtle helps, as does devising menus for fantasy dinners and dreaming of their next voyage. Filled with danger, spirit and tenderness, this is a book about human connection and the human condition, about how we survive, not just at sea, but in life.
Morris fetched the life raft and the dinghy, then collected as many freshwater containers as he could find. Marilyn waded round the galley, filling two sail bags with their things. Two plastic bowls, a bucket, their emergency bag, passports, a camera, a torch, their oil skins, her diary, two books, two dictionaries, and Morris's navigational tools, his nautical almanac and sight reduction tables, his chart, sextant, compass and logbook. They worked fast and in silence, strangely calm as the water rose. It wasn't easy, gathering possessions from a vessel filling with ocean. 10 minutes it took to gather what they could. Then they climbed off the boat into the dinghy. Around them, the Pacific was moving gently. Marilyn watched cushions she'd spent hours embroidering float away on the waves. Their boat settled low in the ocean, then lower. Marilyn found her camera and took a picture of Morris, who was sitting in front of her, shirtless. He turned back to look at her, every muscle of his back delineated under the harsh glare of the sun, wearing an expression not of fear, not yet, but a kind of taut blankness, as if he had not quite grasped what was taking place, the sight of their boat tipping to one side as she sank in the middle of the ocean. She went down so gracefully. The solid bulk of her hull, the deck, cockpit, sails and ropes all quietly swallowed by the water. Marilyn took a picture as the last triangle of sail and the tip of the mast disappeared beneath the surface. Frozen in the photograph, the mast looked like it might be coming the other way, emerging from the water, like a thin arm hoping for rescue.
A final clip there of Florence Howard reading from Morris and Marilyn by Sophie Elmhurst, the non-fiction category winner and the overall winner of Nero Book of the Year. It's available, along with all of the other category winners in accessible formats, from RNIB Library. Just call 0303 123 9999. Or you can head to rniblibrary.com for much more information.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service, and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Familiar voice to RNIB Talking Book users, Steve Hodson has passed away at the age of 77. He was a member of BBC Radio's Drama Repertory Company for almost 40 years, and people of a certain age will remember him in Follyfoot from 1971 to 1973. Here he is telling us how he started narrating for Talking Books.
I had been away from London for years. I'd been up north doing a television programme, and I came back, and I'd only been back about 6 months, and I got a phone call from the man who then ran Talking Books. He was called Ian Turner. He said, "Would you like to do a book?" And I went, "Wow, yes." And so I did one. It's a tester, really. I think it was based up north. I was born in Yorkshire, so the accent was all right. And then I recorded that, and about a week or so later, when it had all been prepped, I suppose, I got a phone call, "Would you like another?" And I said yes, and that was 1975. Even when I went away sort of filming or doing a telly or in theatre, I always had an R&IB book in my bag, either to prep, or I would phone the studios and say, "I've got Wednesday off, I've got a Friday off," and we'd fit. So you're constantly coming in. What's happened here is that I've been asked to do books that I'm not aware of the authors at all, but it's opened me up to them. So I have met new authors and through being here. And that's been fascinating as well. At the moment, I'm doing a book called Gallipoli, which is about the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, written by a man called Alan Moorhead, a great historian. It's a fascinating book. The week before that, I was doing two young adults books. You know, it really keeps the old brain box going, you know. Because you have to be authorial voice, you get to play the men, the women, the children, you have to be everybody. And be aware exactly of what the author's intending. So it's absolutely fascinating. If you think about it too deeply, it's terrifying. And I've met a lot of blind people. I was once in the BBC club having done a play there. And the voice boomed across the bar saying, "You're Steve Hodson." And it was a blind guy with his guide dog. And he just heard my voice talking to someone. And he'd heard loads of books I'd done and things. And he came bounding across the BBC club. And we had a great night. You've got to talk to somebody like him to realise just how much it means. It means that a young historian can keep up with what's going on. Politicians. I mean, I've done all these things, you know. Having done this television series, you used to get fan mail. But I got fan mail from the blind reader. There's nothing like it in the world. You've opened up a whole new world, and books are my passion. I have the hugest personal library. I've got about 6,000 books, which my daughters are now stealing bit by bit, and be able to give that to somebody, oh, it just broke my heart and filled me full of pride as well. And when I decided that really about 3 or 4 years ago that I might start retiring and running down things, the one thing I could not give up for the life in me was RNIB. I love it. I've loved working for them throughout. I've seen so many different bosses and engineers and producers. It's been a magical time.
That was Steve Hodson speaking to us 9 years ago. Around about the same time, while he was still recording for Talking Books, I was doing the Talking Books show on RNIB Connect Radio. And I sent him a very loose script where he could fill in the blanks and tell us about one of his favourite Talking Books.
It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
"Allow me to introduce you," Roland began, then interrupted himself. "No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Woland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?"
"Trousers don't suit cats, Messire," replied the cat with great dignity.
"Sit down and stop all this hot air."
"Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it, but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Marcion Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself."
"Check," said Woland.
"Check it is," rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette.
"So," Woland turned to Margarita, "let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azaziello and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hella. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band."
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master and Margarita together and that they both loved it. But it was going to be her birthday the following week. And he was taking her down to Dorset, and at a certain time on her birthday they were going to be walking along a beach there. And he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in The Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that just because you've recorded a book. I just hope it carries on forever, even when my teeth have fallen out and I'm totally gaga. Even then, I'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming from the studios. I've loved doing it, particularly because we've had some wonderful responses. We all get them. One woman got in touch once, and she was quite late to talking books. But even then, a whole new world had opened up for her. And it was just so exciting to hear that, and makes it all worthwhile. Roberts asked if he could finally add a line to end this, written by him, but I'm going to say it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to Talking Books. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, Steve. From the RNIB CD Sightlines, available from RNIB Talking Books, here's Steve with a little extra reading.
A Blind Man. I do not know what face is looking back whenever I look at the face in the mirror. I do not know what old face seeks its image in silent and already weary anger. Slow in my blindness, with my hand I feel the contours of my face. A flash of light gets through to me. I have made out your hair, colour of ash and at the same time gold. I say again that I have lost no more than the inconsequential skin of things. These wise words come from Milton and are noble. But then I think of letters and of roses. I think, too, that if I could see my features, I would know who I am this precious afternoon. From The Book of Sand by Jorge Luis Borges.
From the book Sightlines, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. A real hidden gem, full of surprises, including many readings from Steve Hodson. The library is on 0303 123 9999. Or you can email helpline@rnib.org.uk or simply head to rniblibrary.com. Now, finally, on today's Read On, here's Mari Hanna with another Books of Our Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading? And you can't pick Little Women because you picked that the last time.
off my head, it would probably be a Famous Five novel. And I think a lot of people will say that. It was of a time, wasn't it? They were always good, fun, adventurous.
Mother, have you heard about our summer holidays yet? Said Julian at the breakfast table. Can we go to Polzeath as usual? I'm afraid not, said his mother. They are quite full up this year. The three children at the breakfast table looked at one another in great disappointment. They did so love the house at Polzeath. The beach was so lovely there too, and the bathing was fine. Cheer up, said Daddy. I dare say we'll find somewhere else just as good for you. And anyway, Mother and I won't be able to go with you this year. Has Mother told you?
No, said Anne. Oh, Mother, is it true? Can't you really come with us on our holidays? You always do.
Well, this time Daddy wants me to go to Scotland with him, said Mother. All by ourselves. And as you are really getting big enough to look after yourselves now, we thought it would be rather fun for you to have a holiday on your own too. But now that you can't go to Polzeath, I don't really quite know where to send you. What about Quentin's? Suddenly said Daddy. Quentin was his brother, the children's uncle. They had only seen him once and had been rather frightened of him. He was a very tall, frowning man, a clever scientist who spent all his time studying. He lived by the sea, but that was about all that the children knew of him. Quentin, said Mother, pursing her lips. Whatever made you think of him? I shouldn't think he'd want the children messing about in his little house. Well, said Daddy, I had to see Quentin's wife in town the other day about a business matter, and I don't think things are going too well for them. Fanny said she'd be quite glad if she could hear of one or two people to live with her for a while, to bring a little money in. Their house is by the sea, you know. It might be just the thing for the children. Fanny is very nice. She would look after them well. Yes, and she has a child of her own too, hasn't she? Said the children's mother. Now, let me see. What's her name? Something funny. Yes, Georgina. How old would she be? About 11, I should think.
Same age as me, said Dick. Fancy having a cousin we've never seen. She must be jolly lonely all by herself. I've got Julian and Anne to play with, but Georgina is just one on her own. I should think she'd be glad to see us.
That's Jan Francis, reading from Five on a Treasure Island, the first book in the Famous Five series by Enid Blyton, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily cuddle up with and reread?
I tend to cuddle up with biographies or something like that. If I'm just wanting to have a little read, I sometimes don't pick up a crime novel, even though I write them and even though I read very many of them because I have to blurb them. One of the reads that I've had recently, I picked up Carrie Gracie's book, Equal, and I thought that was the most amazing book. I don't know if your listeners will know this, but when she wrote it, she was taking on the BBC about equal pay at the time. And it's not the kind of book that I would normally read, but do you know what? I put it down, picked it up and put it down, and, you know, over several months. And it really, I'm not saying it changed my life, but certainly taught me to stand up for myself. And I think that is one book that I would recommend everyone read, whether they're male or female, you know, whether they're an employer or not. It's an amazing book.
recollecting events, I've relied on my own notes of conversations and my detailed diaries, as well as email exchanges, information that's already in the public domain, and the recollections of the many colleagues and friends who were with me on the journey. Interwoven with my own story, I've tried to present an honest account of what I've learned about unequal pay within the wider context of the gender pay gap. Having fought my own battle and witnessed the struggle of many other women inside the BBC and beyond, I have not sought to hide my conclusions on the subject. I don't expect all readers to agree with me on all points, but I am grateful to those who approach this topic with an open mind. Gender pay triggers heated reactions. At various times, I've been called a BBC hater, a man hater, and a virtue signaller. I am none of these things. I love the BBC. This story owes a lot to many great men, and I'm as susceptible to greed and fear as the next person. As well as telling my own story and placing it in a wider context, I offer advice to readers. I've placed that advice where it falls most naturally in the story, but I've also gathered it at the end of the book in case a summary can be helpful to individual women, men, and employers. Some points are specific to the UK legal context, but I hope others will feel relevant to readers wherever they are in the world. The BBC expects its journalists to acknowledge their mistakes and learn from them. I've tried to avoid mistakes of fact or analysis. My research included extensive reading and conversations with scores of lawyers, regulators, employers, unionists, HR professionals, politicians, historians, economists, statisticians, claimants, campaigners, and colleagues. If I have made mistakes, they are mine alone, and I will try to acknowledge them and learn from them. On the subject of following BBC values, I can't help reflecting that my own story would have been different and this book would not have been written if my employer had applied to its own dealings with staff the same high standards it expects of them in dealing with others. The BBC is led by people who are trying to do their best. But on gender pay, I think they made bad decisions and then tried to defend those decisions in a way that damaged trust.
That's a clip of Equal by Carrie Gracie, which is available commercially as read by the author. And is there a book you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Definitely Chris Whittaker, All the Colours of the Dark. It is a book that I absolutely adored. There is not a word that shouldn't be there. It's quite long. It's set over 27 years, I think. Wonderfully written. Absolutely engrossing. You can lose yourself in this book, and I would recommend it to anyone.
I'm glad you picked that one, because you picked that the last time, but there wasn't an audiobook available because you read it early. But there is an audiobook now, as read by Eduardo Ballerini.
From the flat roof of the kitchen, Patch looked out through serried pin oaks and white pine to the loom of St. Francis Mountains that pressed the small town of Montclair into its shade no matter the season. At 13, he believed entirely that there was gold beyond the Ozark Plateau, that there was a brighter world just waiting for him. Though later that morning, when he lay dying in the woodland, he'd take that morning still and purse it till the colors ran, because he knew it could not have been so beautiful. That nothing was ever so beautiful in his life. He climbed back into his bedroom and wore a tricorn and waistcoat and tucked navy slacks into his socks and fanned the knees until they resembled breeches. Into his belt he slid a small dagger, metal alloy, but the bladesmith was skilled enough. Later that day the cops would crawl over the intricacies of his life and discover he was into pirates because he had been born with only one eye. And his mother peddled the romance of a cutlass and eye patch, because often for kids like him, the flair of fiction dulled a reality too severe. In his bedroom, they would note the black flag pinned to hide a hole in the drywall, the closet with no doors, the fan that did not work, and the steeple tone that did. the antique treasure chest his mother had found at a flea market in St. Louis, doubloon movie props, a replica one-shot flintlock pistol. They would bag a roll of firecrackers and the June 1965 Playboy, like they were evidence of something. And then they would see the eye patches. He looked them over carefully, then selected the purple with the silver star. His mother made them, and some of them itched, but the purple was satin smooth. 18 in total. Only one carried the skull and crossbones. He decided he might wear that one on his wedding day, should he ever work up the courage to speak to Misty Meyer. He removed the hat. His hair touched white in summer months and sand come winter, and he combed it, but a tuft by the crown stood to attention like an antenna. In the kitchen, his mother sat. The night shift mortified her skin. "You picking up signals with that thing?" she said, and tried to fix his hair with her palm. "Pass me the Crisco." He ducked away as she laughed. Patch liked his mother's laugh. The weekend before, she'd taken him to Branson to see about a job. Ivy McCauley chased near misses like acceptance of place was the greatest sin. He'd fill up the fare lane with just enough gas, and she'd fill up the cab with excitement, fixing her hair into a fondue shag and squeezing his hand and telling him this was it. He'd wait the interview hour alone in towns he did not know. She'd fixed eggs, and he wondered just how tough it was to be a parent, and if at times all poor kids were some kind of well-intentioned regret. "Today will be the best day of my life," he said. He said that often, because he could not know what would come.
Eduardo Ballerini reading from Chris Whitaker's All the Colours of the Dark. And once again, Mari, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robert, for having me back. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.